your face, Lenore.
All right.
Lenore, my darling. You've been hurt. Somebody's hurt you.
No, keep away from me.
Lenore, come here. Let me hold you.
You, I mean, you don't care about my face. About the way I look.
You look so tired. So sad.
Oh, isn't it? It makes no difference. A job, my darling.
I left them there, holding each other silently, holding each other, and thanking God that after their strange and tortured journey, they had met once more. I knew what Charles Beaumont was planning in his first-rate soul. He was the artist, sketching the plans that the surgeon would execute of a living portrait of Lenore.
At the end of A Portrait of Lenore, Radio City Playhouse from 1949 throws together two opposing thoughts about plastic surgery, prompting us to ask, on the one hand, how necessary is it, and on the other, how effective is it? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
The questions persist, but plastic surgery has come a long way in the past 60 years or so, and there's more to it than turning an obvious disfigurement into a living work of art. What are the materials and methods plastic surgery uses today? How much of it is cosmetic? How long does it last? And how much discussion goes into the decision to perform it? You can see some three-dimensional images of plastic surgery options by going to this website, www.plasticsurgery.org, as we converse during this hour. And our guest is Bradley Manning, a professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and outgoing president of the Wisconsin Medical Society.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let's start with some of those terms, plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, reconstructive surgery. What is it that they all have in common other than making us look better?
Well, plastic surgery is the term that covers all of the surgery. Reconstructive surgery is a large part of plastic surgery, and I think it's one of the parts that people are not always aware of or don't think of when they think about plastic surgery. And cosmetic surgery is another part of plastic surgery and a significant part as well, no question about that. Reconstructive surgery is primarily related to fixing problems that are related to congenital deformities that people have been born with, or correcting problems that come up through people's lives related to injury or perhaps tumors, those kinds of things. Cosmetic surgery is surgery that corrects something that is probably within the range of normal for an individual's age, gender, for that person normally. But cosmetic surgery changes something about that person, and generally we think in terms of making them more beautiful or more handsome, that kind of thing.
How long has this sort of thing been going on?
Well, plastic surgery has an extraordinarily long history. It's remarkable. There is information about plastic surgery or things that we do as plastic surgeons 2,000 years ago. Actually, it's interesting that probably the birth of many techniques in plastic surgery was in India, and it was carried for many, many years actually just in India. And many of the plastic surgery procedures that we've been using for the past 100, 200 years were discovered by the British in India and brought back to the Western world, which is kind of remarkable. The actual specialty of plastic surgery is a much newer entity. During the First World War, there were, of course, a lot of injuries, a lot of casualties. What was different about the First World War? The thing that was different about the First World War was that medicine had progressed to a degree that people were surviving with terrible injuries. And coming back home in wars prior to that, I think that these severe injuries, especially of the face, of the head and neck, were not compatible with life. And these people did not come home. During the First World War, these people did come home and were left with deformities. For instance, maybe absence of the whole lower jaw, the whole lower part of the face, or a half of the upper face missing or gone. And these folks were well enough to do whatever was necessary in society to go back to work, but they were just not able to go back to work because of their appearance. A group of surgeons, and this included general surgeons, ear, nose, and throat surgeons, and dental surgeons as well, got together and decided that they would start to work on these folks and try to rehabilitate them. And they developed, these were the earliest plastic surgeons, they developed a number of techniques. And as I say, many of these techniques were old techniques that had been used for millennia. But they put these techniques together and did work to reconstruct these unfortunate people.
When we say plastic, by the way, that's a kind of a more general sense, meaning something that's malleable, or what is the
actually part of this story, in fact, is that they knew what it was that they were doing, what they were trying to accomplish, but they didn't have a name for the specialty. And there were names for other specialties. There was the generic name surgeon, which is what started out as the folks who did the cutting, and orthopedic surgery was known at that time. Neurosurgery was coming into being at that time, ear, nose, and throat surgery. But there was not a name for this surgery. And so the people went to the books and found a word, and the word was a Greek word, plastikos, which meant to mold or shape. And since they were molding and reshaping these people's faces, they felt that this would be a good name for the surgery. Now, it had been used prior to this time as well. In a similar way, there was work that had been done, for instance, on the nose, rhinoplasty. So the word had been used, but this was the first time this was used as a name for a part of surgery.
And how important was it in the development of plastic surgery, the development of anesthesiology? In other words, if you don't have a way to keep people from feeling the pain, can you do as much work on reconstructing a jaw and so on?
It was absolutely essential. The whole specialty of anesthesia was developed in the mid-1800s, I think around 1843 was the first general anesthetic. And of course, this allowed the surgeon a great deal more freedom to do the things that they needed to do. Prior to this, we, of course, had the proverbial bullet to bite on, or the whiskey that the doctor in the West would use for his surgery. Actually, it wasn't just the doctor in the West who used whiskey. 2,000 years ago, when the Indian surgeons were doing surgery, they talked about first giving the patient wine and preparing them with wine. And when you see the kinds of surgeries that were done at that time, it's remarkable that people were able to put up with the pain and discomfort. I wonder how much wine was necessary.
Yeah, and back in India, was it done for only, as far as you know, for extreme cases of injury or cleft palate or something like that? Or was it even then done for sort of more beauty, concepts of beauty?
No, it was very much a reconstructive procedure back in India. And this is 700-800 B.C., the nose has importance in different societies, different kinds of importance. And apparently in India, it was a very important part of the body. And so, since it was so important, it was an area that was focused on for punishment as well, so that criminals might be punished by having their nose cut off. Adultery has always been a reason that various societies have given for cutting off noses. And the idea, I think, was to label this person so that they were shamed and easily recognized. Because of this loss, there was, of course, a need by people to try to do something about this, to try to correct this problem. And that generated the need for the surgery. So this early surgery was primarily related to reconstructing noses that had been cut off. And I think it was apparently fairly successful.
What kind of methods did they use? What materials did they have to work with?
Well, in plastic surgery, if we have a choice, we want to work with the material of the body, of that individual's body. That always works best. And so the methods that these ancient surgeons used was to use a flap of tissue, that is an extension of tissue. And for instance, in trying to reconstruct the nose, they would use an area of excess tissue from the cheek, for instance, or the forehead. And they would turn that tissue down into the area of the nose and hook that up to the nose to reconstruct the nose. The defect that was left could either be closed up primarily on the cheek, or it was just allowed to heal in on the forehead and healed in quite well.
Which would look better than having a part of your nose missing.
Much better.
And if we look at some of those World War I injuries that were being handled by plastic surgeons, how far have we come since that time in terms of what would be done with someone who had, you know, part of their face blown off?
We've come a long, long way. What's somewhat remarkable is that we use many of the same techniques, but we have great advances. You mentioned general anesthesia. That's a huge, huge benefit. We have clean or sterile operating rooms. We have electrocautery, which is a little jolt of electricity that closes blood vessels that keeps an area from bleeding. We have wonderful sutures. We have wonderful needles that are attached directly to the suture, the suture being the thread to close up wounds, which when pulled through the tissue causes very little damage. We have amazing things that make our lives much more reasonable compared to the lives of these ancient surgeons.
Where do we first find surgery, not so much in the sense of just improving a person's looks, but in terms of repairing, a tumor removal, that kind of thing?
Well, again, it's remarkable to me that there was this surgery that was done 2,000 years ago. There was a long hiatus, and I think the Middle Ages may have been a particularly difficult time for surgeons and doctors in general, physicians, because I think there was a feeling that some of this was connected with witchcraft and that kind of thing. So I think, among other things in the Middle Ages that went bad, I think medicine didn't make the progress that it might have made. But following that period of time, surgery did, I think, start to improve dramatically. And, of course, we've been aware of problems, for instance, tumors, for a long, long time. Unfortunately for people in the past, in general, that awareness did not allow any kind of treatment because, again, we didn't have the tools and the techniques to be able to do that. People did try to do things. The mainstay of surgery through the Civil War was amputation. And the mark of a great surgeon during that period of time was how quickly they could do an amputation. And when we say quickly, we're talking about 30 seconds, 45 seconds.
With a saw.
With a saw.
Ouch.
And unfortunately, if you amputate somebody's leg and you don't control the bleeding, which was something that they didn't have an ability to do, then they might very well die of
exsanguinating.
Of exsanguination, yeah. So it was all very primitive through that period of time. It was really after that time that there started to be some ways to intervene. General anesthetic, I mentioned again, as one of the great advances. And we learned a lot about blood and about preserving blood, collecting blood, using blood from one person and putting it into another person. That was a great advance. As I say, electrocautery was another great advance. And all of these things happened towards the end of the 1800s into the 1900s. That's when the real renaissance started at that period of time.
And if we talk about breast cancer, for example, does it become plastic surgery not when you sort of remove the cancer, that I assume that's just the surgery itself, but when you sort of reconstruct what's left? Or, I mean, at what point does it become plastic surgery if you have a woman with breast cancer?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. The surgeon does the removal, whatever that might be, and that can be various levels of removal, anywhere from a lumpectomy, just removing part of the breast, to removing the entire breast. And then the plastic surgeon is asked to come in at that point in time and do a reconstruction of the breast. And that's when it becomes plastic surgery at that point. And there are a number of different techniques that can be used to reconstruct a breast after mastectomy.
And how far have we come on that? It seems as if, for one thing, the surgeries are less invasive than they used to be. Sometimes, I mean, it seems as if people are able to accomplish surgery with less cutting than in the past.
Well, our approach to breast cancer is much different now than when I started in this business, which was around 1970, 75. At that time, there was really only one operation. That was a modified radical mastectomy or a radical mastectomy, removing the entire breast, sometimes removing more than the entire breast, removing the muscle of the chest. These were quite substantial defects, and there was really no technique for reconstructing a breast. People did try. Everything has been attempted in the past, and every time we do something, we find that it's been done before somewhere along the line. But it was very unsatisfactory at that time. I remember when I started my plastic surgery fellowship that we were just at that point in time starting to try to reconstruct a breast using an implant, a silicone implant. And our thought was we would remove the breast and the breast tissue and then just put a silicone implant in the place where the breast had been and sew everything up. That was not very effective. That did not work very well at all. But it started us off on trying to develop ways to do breast reconstruction in an effective way. And so our next step was to put in a tissue expander that is essentially a balloon made out of silicone that could be put into the defect where the breast had been removed. The skin was closed, and then over a period of time, we could inject saline or salt water into that expander and slowly stretch the tissue over time, which allowed us to make a space that would take an implant. So those were really the first reasonable and reasonably successful breast reconstructions that were done. And those were done in the late 70s, the first ones.
Those silicone implants, though, became kind of notorious, didn't they?
They did. That's another interesting story. That happened about 1990 when there was a strong outpour of concern about the safety of silicone breast implants. And there was a feeling that silicone breast implants caused a number of significant problems. And many of those problems were autoimmune type problems, scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis, a number of autoimmune type diseases which people were convinced were caused by silicone breast implants. The list was much longer than that. The problem at that time was that there was absolutely no information to refute that idea. No one had collected any information. Nobody had any idea that there was going to be a question about the safety of breast implants. At that time, they'd been used for almost 30 years and really had been very few questions asked about them. They were actually generated at the time, and I can remember this time myself, when we used to talk about medical miracles. And everything that happened in medicine was kind of a miracle. That's when they were first operating on children, doing heart surgery on children and doing heart valve replacements in the 60s on adults as well. And we looked at all of these things as just amazing miracles. And we didn't look at them too critically. And we paid a price with that too. For instance, heart valves, they used to have a sort of a ping pong ball in a cage heart valve. And over the years, we found that those ping pong balls did not last. They eventually started to deteriorate and would shatter and cause essentially instant death. So those were lessons that were lessons that we had to learn over time. And I guess one of the lessons that we learned, or we thought we might be learning, was that there was a problem with breast implants. And that was first brought forward in the 90s. Well, what we needed to do was we needed to have information. We needed to collect information about breast implants, and that was done over the next 5 to 10 years. Information was collected. The big studies were done by the Mayo Clinic and by the Harvard School of Public Health, and they looked at women who'd had breast implants in for many years and compared them with another group of women who had not had breast implants in for many years but had similar backgrounds, and they found that the problems that folks had been talking about were seen in both groups in equal numbers. So there did not seem to be any increase in risk for these problems in people who had breast implants. And so today, silicone breast implants are available essentially without restriction.
What's the screening process for that kind of thing? Does it go through the FDA, or how are those things screened before they're put into use?
Well, again, that was part of the problem in the 60s when things were medical miracles. Nobody looked at them at all. And if somebody came up with an idea, then they would just go ahead and use that thing, and they would find some patients, and they might tell them that this is risky, and they might not. But that was just the way things were done. As time went on, as we had things like the problems with the heart valves, it became clear that somebody needed to watch over this whole area. And it was decided that the FDA would do that. The FDA at that time was not a bit happy about that. It's Food and Drug Administration. Yeah. So they were perfectly happy to do food and drug, but they weren't very interested in going into medical devices. They had no background. But they were essentially forced to take on that job, and they're the ones who do oversee medical devices now. Now, breast implants came out in 1963, and that was about 10 years before the FDA got involved in looking at medical devices. And there were a number of things that had been developed over the years, and the FDA had such a huge list of things to do that they said, if things have been developed in the past, we won't necessarily look at those things, at least not now.
Kind of grandfather them.
Unless there's a problem, we'll grandfather them in. If there is a problem, we'll look at them. We plan to cover everything within the next 20 years, even the things that hadn't been examined by the FDA. And that's about the same time that 1990, when the questions were raised about silicone breast implants.
More in the field of plastic surgery when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Bradley Manning. This hour, we're discussing plastic surgery, and we've talked about some pretty big applications that came out of World War I in particular and the years following. But it does make me wonder what actually day-to-day is the most prevalent practice of plastic surgery.
We do have information about that. Plastic surgery is moving into the modern age, and we're collecting information now which has not been done in the past, and it's important. But what we find is that as far as total numbers of procedures that are done, there are about 16 million non-cosmetic or reconstructive type procedures done by plastic surgeons and about 10 million or 11 million cosmetic procedures done by plastic surgeons. When I say plastic surgeons, I'm talking about members of the Society of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons, which is a specific area. There's plastic surgery done by a lot of folks, not just that group of people. It's also done by ear, nose, and throat people who are commonly facial plastic surgeons. It's done by eye surgeons, oculoplastic surgeons, dermatologists, dermatologic plastic surgery. And there are folks who do plastic surgery who are general surgeons or not surgeons at all as well. So there are a lot of people doing plastic surgery, but these numbers are related to the folks who are members of the Society of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons who are board certified as, quote, plastic surgeons.
So within that area, the non-cosmetic, the 16, you said 16 million a year of non-cosmetic surgeries, what within that area would be the most common forms of surgery?
Well, this was a surprise, I think, to all of us when we found out what the most common procedure was done by plastic surgeons, and that procedure turns out to be tumor removal. And by tumor removal, I don't mean a large tumor, a large malignant tumor. I mean essentially any kind of lesion that's removed. So that could be a mole, it could be a small skin cancer, could be a cyst. But that turns out to be the most common plastic surgical procedure that's done by this group of people.
Are we seeing changes in the sort of thing that's done? I mean, there's so much more awareness of sun damage now than there was 40 years ago. Are we seeing more of that kind of work?
I think that is true. I think that we're much more careful about changing skin lesions, and I think it's a very important thing to be careful about. I think that in general, the public is much more attuned to any kind of a changing skin lesion. They're interested in it. Commonly, or most of the time, in order for us to know exactly what a skin lesion is, we really need to take it off and have that checked by a pathologist. Now, there are certainly things that we look at that we have less concern about and we let go. But if we have any question or concern, the only way to know about it is to take it off and have it checked by a pathologist. We are all, I think, more concerned and aware of sun exposure as a risk factor for skin cancer. And especially malignant melanoma is a skin cancer which is the most serious of the skin cancers and can be a life-threatening problem. I think that's one that many people are aware of nowadays. What I think we're seeing is a lot more people coming in early. I think we're seeing less malignant melanomas that are advanced, which is a good thing. I think that's a great benefit of the awareness that people have of changing skin lesions. So if we can catch malignant melanoma earlier, we have a much better chance of that not going on to cause further problems for that patient.
So if tumor removal is the most common non-cosmetic plastic surgery, what are some of the other ones that you find?
The list shows that laceration repair is the next most common thing that plastic surgeons do. That's one of the things that brings us into the emergency room at night is a laceration.
You know, like cutting your finger, that sort of thing?
Cutting a finger, facial cuts. Some body cuts are extensive and might require a plastic surgeon's attention as well. So that's the kind of thing that we might see, especially in the emergency room. And then hand surgery is the next most common thing that plastic surgeons do. I think it may be a little bit surprising that hand surgery is something that plastic surgeons do. Plastic surgeons do hand surgery, orthopedic surgeons do hand surgery, and some general surgeons do hand surgery. Plastic surgeons were involved more in hand surgery in the 30s, and then it seemed to kind of move more into the orthopedic realm. As we got into the new surgeries that involved preserving tissue that had been cut off, so for instance, when there was a young man whose arm was taken off when he was riding a train and went through a tunnel.
This famous
was around,
case.
Yeah, around 1963, I think, or so. His arm was replanted, is the term, and it survived. Haven't heard much about how functional it was. My guess is it probably was not terribly functional, but when fingers, for instance, are cut off or even a whole hand is cut off, there often is an opportunity to be able to reconnect the blood vessels and put that appendage back on again. And these can be very functional. And when fingers started being replaced, I think that started to get the plastic surgeons more involved again in hand surgery and reaffirm their place in hand surgery as well.
Doing the reattachments or just prettying them up?
No, doing the reattachments. So no cosmetic purpose in this, really, although it always is nice to have all of your parts. But actually doing the reattachment, and it's all been pretty well worked out now. The first thing you have to do is stabilize the amputated part, and so the bones need to be put back together again. And then the next area generally is to get the blood supply to that tissue. And so when we're talking about a cut at the wrist, those vessels are pretty large, and most vascular surgeons would be happy to work on those blood vessels. But when we're talking about a finger, we're talking about blood vessels that are a millimeter in diameter. They are tiny. And those blood vessels have to be put back together under a microscope. And that is something that many orthopedic surgeons might not be interested in doing. And for whatever reason, plastic surgeons are interested in doing it. So that really rekindled an interest in hand surgery and plastic surgery.
Is there any use of stem cells in helping with plastic surgery?
I know that stem cells are very much involved in research aspects of plastic surgery right now, and there is a lot of work being done with stem cells. I don't know of any practical applications that are being used at this point in time in plastic surgery related to stem cells, but the hope is that at some point in time we may be able to grow parts that people have lost and recreate them. We're long, long way away from that right now, but that would be something that might happen in the future.
And how much better are we now at fixing things up where people are left with no scar?
We're a long way from that, too. That is the holy grail of plastic surgery, is to operate without leaving a scar. And that has been worked on for at least 80 years, but probably much longer than that. Various things have been tried. I'd have to say that I don't know that we've made much progress along those lines. One thing that I always try to mention is that anytime we make a cut, there will be a permanent scar. And there's been confusion about that related to plastic surgery. In fact, there are a lot of folks who have been led to believe that there is a way to do surgery without leaving a scar. And I will sometimes have folks come to my office saying that they came to see a plastic surgeon because they didn't want a scar. That is a frightening situation for me, and I have to quickly let those folks know that there will unfortunately be a scar. Now, scars are not all bad, and as we all get older, as I'm doing quickly right now, our scars start to blend in with our normal body lines. And I think that's
really... How comforting.
Really, see, it's another benefit of aging.
There you go. It just all kind of camouflages. When it comes to cosmetic surgery, then you're saying if somebody has, their whatever the term would be, to clean up those lines around the eyes or take wrinkles away from the bridge of the nose or something, that there's actually going to be a scar?
There will definitely be a scar. And the secret of cosmetic plastic surgery is finding ways to hide those scars. So, for instance, in a facelift, the incision is made starting in the hairline just behind the sideburn, carried down in front of the ear or along the edge of the ear, sometimes even putting the incision within the ear canal, down to the base of the ear, then back behind the ear, back into the hairline. So that is a scar that does not show up much at all, especially if you have hair that covers that area. Mm-hmm. In doing rhinoplasty or cosmetic surgery of the nose, the incisions are often made completely inside the nose. So that there is a scar, but the scar is inside the nose and
who cares if it doesn't show and it doesn't itch?
That's sort of invisible at that point in time. So this is the secret to doing these kinds of surgery, is to put the scars in places where they won't be seen or noticed.
And what is a scar? Is it just, you know how there's just sort of a little white line? Is that just sort of a dead area, or what? Why is there a white line?
Well, you know, scars are actually a good thing. Scars are our body's ability to heal up an injury, so that if we have a cut either caused by a stone or a rock or caused by a sharp surgical blade, the alternative would be for that wound to stay open, and that would not be very good. So the body has remarkable abilities to heal itself, and one of the ways it heals itself is by forming a scar. A scar is a collection of collagen, which is sort of one of the basic building blocks of the body. It gives the body substance. And collagen is deposited between the two edges of the wound, and it binds the wound together. Now, collagen has a good side and a bad side. The good side is that it will bind the scar together. The bad side is if the collagen continues to be produced, it makes a heavier and heavier scar. And there are abnormal kinds of healing. For instance, keloid scarring, where there's deposition of collagen that continues and continues and continues and can cause the scar to become huge. We have, as I say, been working for many, many years to try to find a way to control the way the collagen is deposited. We'd like to have a nice thin line that you're mentioning, but again, so far our control methods are pretty coarse and they aren't always effective. But it is an aim for us to someday be able to control that process.
For cosmetic surgery, are there fashions, are there trends, are there years in which everybody suddenly is getting the tummy tuck or, the facelift?
Absolutely, absolutely. From the point of view of cosmetic surgery, of course, the early cosmetic procedures were facelift, rhinoplasty, tummy tuck, which is taking up the excessive skin of the abdomen, usually often related to pregnancy. As time went on, we had some new ways to approach problems cosmetically. Breast augmentation was certainly a big difference, a big change. When breast augmentation came out in 1963, it was seldom used procedure, more common with folks in the entertainment business than anything else. But it did eventually make a transition to become a much more acceptable intervention. And it quickly rose to the most popular cosmetic plastic surgery procedure. as time has gone on, there have been new procedures. For instance, liposuction, which started in around 1980, that then became the most common procedure that was done. Today, actually, the most commonly done cosmetic procedures are less invasive kinds of procedures, like injection of Botox into the forehead or into wrinkles.
John Kerry became kind of notorious in that, did he or didn't he, with Botox during the election.
And I don't know.
But you're moving into an area, too, that brings up an entire area of controversy, which would be, I guess, surgery done to fit some cultural standard of beauty or youth that comes with its own risks. But then you have all these people that want to have, you know, fewer wrinkles or larger breasts or something, not for medical reasons.
Do you ever just talk people out of it? You say, look, you look fine the way you are. Why go through this?
I do. I do. And I think most plastic surgeons do. This is an area that is somewhat difficult. I think that it's very important, especially in cosmetic plastic surgery, to make sure that the surgeon and the patient are both on the same wavelength and that the patient's expectations are in the same realm as the surgeon's expectations. And you might think that, there shouldn't be a problem with that, but there often is. One of the things that I think we're most concerned about is if we see a patient who has a, for instance, cosmetic complaint that we have difficulty seeing, that patient probably will be very difficult to satisfy because there isn't something that's obviously correctable.
Do you ever try to refer them to a psychiatrist?
Well, I haven't done that myself, but I might talk with their primary care doctor and express a concern that I have about that problem and see if the primary care doctor might do that.
But it's also a big business. Lots of money gets made. Right?
Absolutely.
So that if you have a lot of women who think they need bigger breasts or, you know, lack of wrinkles or not to look as if they ever had a child, if you have all these different ways you can improve yourself now and they bring in money to a hospital and so on, it seems a little bit tricky on an ethical level.
Well, and I don't mean to say that there aren't appropriate places to do cosmetic surgery. I think there are. And I think as long as the patient and the physician kind of agree that this is what they want to do and why they want to do it, and everybody's realistic about it, I think it's quite good. I think there are many, many people who are very satisfied with cosmetic surgery that they've had. I think if people start to develop a long list of cosmetic procedures that they've had, again, we're starting to talk about that perhaps being something that isn't necessarily a healthy kind of interest.
Do you have figures for how many more women than men tend to have these cosmetic procedures?
It certainly is more common in women, and I don't have the numbers, but I would guess that it's probably 80%, 20%, or perhaps even more of a difference.
And holding steady, not a greater
trend
men, for men.
Men are now interested in cosmetic plastic surgery. So I wouldn't say it's holding steady. I think, if anything, there are more and more men getting interested in doing some cosmetic plastic surgery. So I think it's actually probably becoming more equal.
And is there, injury notwithstanding, is there an age framework where you say, oh, yeah, the curve goes up for plastic surgery, cosmetic plastic surgery at a certain age, and then it drops off again at a certain age?
Well, the different procedures have different levels of interest. So, for instance, a breast augmentation probably is more interesting to a woman between the ages of 18 and 40. Not exclusively, but that's probably a higher level of interest time. And then, of course, the aging types of surgery, facelift, mastopexy, which is a breast lift, abdominoplasty, are all procedures that are more common, I think, as people get through their 40s into their 50s. But there does seem to be a trend, not so much in our area, but on the coasts, to younger and younger people having these procedures like facelift or abdominoplasty.
Some more observations about plastic surgery when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Everyone saw a fat nose on thick legs. Her good nature wore out like a fan belt, so she cut off her nose and her legs and offered them up. In the casket displayed on satin, she lay with the undertaker's cosmetics painted on, a turned-up putty nose, dressed in a pink and white nightie. Doesn't she look pretty, everyone said. Consummation at last, to every woman, a happy ending. That's from the poem Barbie Doll by Marge Piercy. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Bradley Manning, and we're talking about plastic surgery. There is a website, www.plasticsurgery.org, that has diagrams and information about a lot of the procedures that we are talking about. Let's, again, just sort of reiterate the difference between cosmetic surgery that doesn't have to be done and then something that's reconstructive, like taking a child with a cleft palate and giving them a chance to have a sort of a face that's not disfigured. Is this something that you struggle with yourself with the field of plastic surgery, is that it has both this wonderful give someone a new life, a new face for accidents or birth defects, but then also hits teenage girls trying to look like Barbie doll?
That poem is very touching, and it concerns me. And I hate to hear about the pressures that I know many, many young girls are under. Yes, I do worry a bit. And I think that, in general, plastic surgeons want to be sensitive to the kinds of pressures that are put on, probably self-pressure or peer pressure that are put on, especially young girls. I think we have to be very, very careful about that. Whenever I see, especially a young girl, but actually young boys often come in with questions or concerns as well, I want to spend a lot of time with those people. Generally, they come in with their parents as well. And I want the parents to spend a lot of time as well. We need to really think about what it is that we're doing. And probably the procedure itself that they might be looking for really isn't the answer. That's not going to help them through this period of trouble that they're having, this concern that they have. And some will eventually get a procedure done, but some may not. And again, I think the key is that they get a chance to really, really think about the implications of what it is that they're doing.
Who would be the prime candidate for this procedure that you mentioned earlier? And we hear a lot about liposuction.
Well, liposuction, I think, has very limited use. And it's not a general weight reduction technique. It should not be used for that. And periodically, we do see patients who assume that it might be good to reduce their weight. Liposuction really has its value in situations where people have lost weight, where they've gotten down to the weight that they'd like to be at, but have a problem area, you know, perhaps a little extra fat on the sides of the thighs, some extra fat on the buttocks area, maybe a little bit of extra fat on the abdomen. That's the ideal situation to use liposuction in, touching up a small area.
And how does that actually work? It sounds,
well,
I mean, is it what it sounds like?
It's worse than it sounds. No, it's not bad. And patients are either asleep for the operation or have local anesthetic put in, so they don't have any pain. But a small incision is made near the area that's going to be treated, and a cannula, which is essentially a pipe, a sterile pipe, is placed into the area that is to be treated and is run back and forth. And essentially the fat is vacuumed up into the cannula with strong suction. It sounds primitive, and it perhaps looks a little primitive if you've seen it on television, but it works quite well as long as it's used in the right circumstances.
What do you do with all the extra skin? I assume there would be some.
Well, that's a great question. I think that's one of the reasons why liposuction works well in certain situations and not in others. Liposuction tends to work better in younger people. Younger people have a great ability to take up the slack. They have elasticity of their skin. As we all get older, we lose more and more of that elasticity, and we don't respond as well to liposuction as we would have 20 years ago. In that case, it is necessary to remove some of the skin as well. And so it's a little bit different operation at that point in time.
For someone wanting to have, you know, an extreme makeover and reduce all signs of aging, besides Botox, what other things are now available that people are trying?
Well, there are, again, some of these minimally invasive techniques include chemical peeling, and there are a number of things that are used to do chemical peels.
What does that mean, chemical peels?
Chemical peel
is, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
It doesn't.
And it's pretty much what it sounds like. So a chemical is put on the skin in a very controlled way. And there are various chemicals that can be used, and the difference in the chemicals will cause different levels of peel. And it's, to some extent, a light peel using glycolic acid, for instance, will cause something similar to a sunburn. So it will turn the skin red. It will dry it up to some extent. There may be a little peeling of the skin. And the patients are often left with some tightening or firming of the skin. The deeper peels will actually cause redness and scabbing of the skin, and redness that lasts for several weeks, even months, and may change the pigment of the skin completely. And that's a much different kind of a thing. But the result is more tightening of the skin. So it becomes a balancing act of how much tightening you want to do and what you're willing to give up in doing something like that. So if somebody has significant changes in the pigment of their skin, those folks, even if they have smooth skin, will probably have to spend a lot of time with cosmetics and use foundation and that kind of thing, which is a big commitment over time. So, again, it has to be thought about very carefully.
Let me ask a two-part question here. We do hear about hair removal. Would hair implants also be an aspect of plastic surgery?
Sure. Yeah.
Hair restoration?
Hair restoration is another area of plastic surgery. So hair removal has become a very popular part of plastic surgery and dermatology and even non-surgical kinds of situations. It does seem to work actually quite well. A laser is used primarily. There are other techniques as well, but laser can be used. It certainly gives a good result. I think most people who do laser hair removal will tell you that some of the hair will come back again. They think in terms usually of 10 or 20% of the hair coming back again, and that can be retreated so that as you retreat, you'll have less and less. But it is effective. On the other side of the fence are folks like me who are losing their hair and would like to have a little more hair on their head. And there have been a lot of techniques developed over the years to augment that hair that we've lost over time. It turns out that the hair in the back of the head seems to have more staying power than the hair on the top of the head, for instance. And the hair has some genetic memory, so that if you take that hair from the back of the head and you cut it up into individual follicles, you can put it into a place on the scalp where there is no hair, and you can get a very reasonable recreation of the hairline. That's another somewhat expensive but can be very effective technique for restoring hair.
What about other countries? Are they obsessed with plastic surgery to the extent that we are?
Well, I doubt that they're as obsessed as we are in the United States. It certainly is popular, quite popular in Europe. In fact, many of the advances in plastic surgery, for instance, liposuction was developed in Europe. So it's popular across the globe, perhaps not as popular as it is in the United States, though.
You know, every time I turn on my computer, just about there's an ad that'll pop up offering to remove wrinkles and do this and surgery for different things. For somebody that is, I guess, worried about having it done the wrong way, do you have any advice other than, first of all, to think that maybe your concept of beauty is off for cultural reasons, but let's say it's something that needs to happen. Do you worry about them going to the wrong places now that there's so much advertising?
There is a lot of advertising. There are a lot of people who are doing plastic surgery. We talked earlier about that. And many of these folks are board certified in plastic surgery, board certified in otolaryngology or ear, nose, and throat, board certified in dermatology or oculoplastic surgery, eye surgery. But there also are people who are doing cosmetic plastic surgery who are not certified as surgeons at all, and some who are not even physicians. So I think it's very, very important to make sure that you do your homework and ask your surgeon about their background, what their training is, what kind of certification they have. It's perfectly reasonable to ask a surgeon to show you what he or she has done. Numbers of procedures are important, pictures of what they've done. Sometimes it's possible to talk with a patient who's had the surgery. So I think in this kind of surgery, this is very important. It's expensive. Cosmetic surgery is not paid for by insurance companies in general. Reconstructive surgery is paid for by insurance companies in general. But it's important to do your homework, make sure that you're not going in a direction that could be dangerous or at least not satisfying.
Our guest this hour has been Bradley Manning, filling us in regarding the applications and methods of plastic surgery. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Christopher Taylor returns. Having performed all 32 of the Beethoven piano sonatas in concert, he will look very closely with us at the very last of the 32. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.